Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Good evening. Welcome to Comedy Half Hour. Thank you for coming. This is part of the World Cup Legacy Programme, which is quite appropriate because this is the first one we've done after the World Cup. So if you like, it's a retrospective. Richard Shorewright is with us. Forces beyond his control, meaning he can't be physically with us, but he is recording us. So hopefully this will still go out as a podcast and a live stream. He's not moving, which always worries me because it looks like his picture might have frozen, but we'll carry on anyway. With us tonight, I don't even know how to introduce you. Man of many hats, David Butler, wheelchair international referee, chairman of the Sheffield Eagles Foundation, general manager of European Rugby League.
Occasional 40-20 contributor.
Father of two. Yeah, when we get desperate, we ring him up and give him a story. been involved in rugby league in development probably for almost for about as long as I've been alive. Now you're a lot younger than me. So he will be able to tell you exactly about what European Rugby League have got planned to cash in on this wonderful World Cup. And the man with the fantastic flat cap, who you will have noticed is also wearing the livery of the USA Wheelchair Rugby League team, is Juan Gesso, which I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Close enough. Close enough.
Who again has a long history with the sport involving playing it, coaching it, strength and conditioning, been at London Broncos, been at Keighley. Halifax.
Halifax as a reserve coach, a reserve strength conditioning coach. Done some work with Huddersfield Giant Community Trust, strength conditioning with the academy boys there. Coached at Caldwell College, Kirklees College, and have also, you know, helped out with international development with Mexico and Argentina, and just, you know, loads of different things.
So. But forget all of that, because at the moment he's involved with the USA Wheelchair Team, which clearly has been one of the huge success stories of the World Cup. Played in Sheffield, bounce of a ball maybe away from making the semi-finals, but have only played three games in their entire existence, but looked to me to be one of the real success stories of the World Cup, which we'll find out from the inside in a minute. So do you want me to carry on or...?
You can carry on, Phil. I mean, I do feel like I'm very much a spectator today, which is pretty much like every program we do at the minute. So I'm happy for you to just carry on and ask questions.
Whether we're any good or not, Linda. So we'll take it from here.
You know, I usually ask daft questions anyway, so you know, you feel free to take over.
I can ask a daft question. For those that don't know but don't really need to know, I'm Phil Kaplan, part of 4020, managing editor of the magazine, and we do this on the road thing as well. So feel free during the course of this evening, while we'll discuss everything World Cup, to just throw in any questions. It's pretty much laissez-faire. So anything you want to know that we're not covering, shout up. But we'll start by getting retrospective from the guys on the World Cup. You were both involved. We were privileged enough to watch you from the outside. So the first big question is, what was it like for you from the inside?
I had two roles at the World Cup. So for the first 3 weeks, I went to 10 or 12 games in the men's tournament as a spectator. So supporting the teams from European Rugby League. And obviously that includes Lebanon and Jamaica as well. So I made sure that I got out and saw as many of the members as I could. You know, it's rare that we have the opportunity to see people face to face. So went from sort of, you know, nice hospitality rooms to nice hospitality room to nice hospitality room across the country. Two games here in Doncaster, which were both fabulous to see as well. Obviously, England v Greece at Bramall Lane was fantastic for Sheffield, but also for South Yorkshire as well, to have a game of that prestige here. And then all of that ended on Halloween, so it went from treat to trick. And I went into camp with the match officials team for the wheelchair team. So we had for the tournament. So we had a couple of days in camp in a hotel in Sheffield where we did some training. We talked about the way the game should be played and moderated the laws. So colleagues from France and Australia definitely.
We know all about your colleagues from France.
Played.
We're not going to
talk about that either. But the game is played very differently in Australia, particularly. And so we talked about, you know, how presentation-wise it would look and things. And then literally at lunchtime on the Wednesday, they read out the appointments and the team of officials that were officiating in London got on a bus and went to London. I wasn't one of those, and I'm not going to lie, that hurt. I wanted to be involved in that opening game and be there for the buzz at the Copper Box. So, so I watched that on the TV in Sheffield with Steve Abel and Grant Jackson. Not quite what I wanted to do. But then I was involved in France v Wales the next day. And unlike my colleagues, I got to go to bed at 10:30. They arrived back from London 1:30, and we were all on the bus at 8:00 the next morning to get to the EIS. So it was fantastic. It was very, it was quite frantic for us because we had back-to-back games in London, then Sheffield, then a day off. But that day off was match review, train, and get on the bus to get back down to London if you were selected. So I only actually went to the Copper Box once. I think I was the only one in the squad that had the pleasure of that. But in a way, I was quite happy with that as well because it's a long way down there and back in the minibus to, you know, just to you know, to be tired and then have to go into other games and things. But it's a phenomenal experience. Learned loads. You know, obviously being involved in all those games and seeing the different players, different athletes, and you always have that arm's length sort of distance between the players and the officials, but built some friendships, I think, as well. You know, Facebook, I had to ignore all my Facebook requests during the tournament, but could release all of those on Saturday last week. But it's great to see, you know, so many games played. And then we had the semi-finals, so we got picked for the semi-finals and things. And then the squad of eight was cut down to five. It was quite like The Apprentice, really. There weren't eight suitcases lined up in reception in the hotel, but it did feel like it. And the five of us that were selected for the finals then went home to Manchester and we integrated with the running game squad in the apartments that they were in and trained and prepared for the game on Friday night. And what a fantastic way to end the tournament. 4,500
We'll come
people,
to that in a minute. Don't peek too soon.
Won't peek too
it was
soon.
Only one question.
Yeah, it was
20 minutes later.
So, no, it was good. But, you know.
So you gave us the officiating side of it. Mm. But I think for me, who's had the privilege of going to... Gone to 30 of the matches live and really enjoyed them. I think the successes, if you look at the three different tournaments... For the men, the first half of the tournament was telling stories. So it was Greece and it was Jamaica and it was Lebanon. If they hadn't been there, we wouldn't have been able to tell their wonderful stories, the people that played for them and what it would mean for them. For the women, it was Brazil. They were just ridiculously refreshing. They have a an outlook on life that not only is uplifting, but actually reminds you of why you fell in love with rugby league in the first place. And for the wheelchair, for me, it was the USA. So before we talk about the potential impact that the USA might have on global rugby league, what's it been like for you? But firstly, the preparation, because it's a huge country. You're given the task of forming wheelchair rugby league. You've got, what, maybe a year that you know that you're going to be there, then another year that you weren't expecting. And you get a group of people together that have never played a competitive game before. Mm. And they come here in their very first game, defeat an established nation. Just how exciting was the whole journey for you? And tell us a bit about the detail of it.
For us, it was, well, for me particularly afterwards, it was a huge relief because of all the time and energy and just stress involved with making this happen. We knew we had something special with the players that we had training back in the U.S., even though we hadn't played yet. But we looked at, you know, Ireland play. We looked at Wales. We looked at Scotland. We looked at France and England. I was at the England-Wales match, not this year, last summer at EIS.
Yeah, yeah.
I was at the England-France match at Gillingham down in Kent last November. So all of that helped with our preparations, and obviously having the tournament postponed also helped us because we knew, hey, these are things that we've picked up and now we can work on these for an extra, you know, 9 months before we leave. And obviously trying to recruit more players and widen that player pool, and just it was stressful for me as the general manager to put all this together. And during the World Cup, I missed a lot of the great events that happened because I was behind the scenes running around, you know, like a madman trying to get things done so that the players could just focus on playing, the head coach would focus on, you know, doing his job, the physio can focus on her job, and everyone just did what they needed to do. But we learned so much from this tournament. It was exactly what I thought it was going to be, which was fantastic and ridiculously hectic and stressful at the same time, but also just an amazing reward for the players to be able to play in this tournament. And we knew we had a strong opportunity before we even flew out here that there was a possibility we could make the semifinals. And, you know, very close.
In terms of recruitment, I mean, clearly there is a huge untapped market for adaptive sport. But you tapped into the military as well, and that was quite important. The core of your squad came through that service background, which indeed you yourself are.
Yes, that's correct. There's a lot of service members in the U.S. who have injuries linked to serving in the military and are now adaptive athletes and have obviously movement challenges and disabilities from serving in the military. In the U.S., there's probably about four different organizations that put on adaptive sports tournaments every year, one of them being the National Veterans Wheelchair Games, which is huge. It's played over about 10 days. With over 800 veterans playing 14 different adaptive sports. We went there this year, set up a stall, and we're telling about rugby league, and they went, oh, I can't play rugby. I'm not disabled enough. And we were like, no, this isn't quad rugby. This isn't murder ball. It's wheelchair rugby league. And we were showing them the England-France game, and they were like, well, is there a classification system? No classification system. And the second question was, well, can we get penalized for hitting too hard? And I was like, no. They were like, well, sign me up. Which is fantastic to hear that they have that sort of energy.
Yeah.
Do they play wheelchair American football?
They're starting to. None of our players do, but they are starting to have a wheelchair American football league in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's being spearheaded by the NFL, obviously.
Yeah.
But we haven't come across any of those players yet. We will eventually.
I was just wondering who we were competing with.
Well, right now, the main competitor for us as a wheelchair team in the U.S., it's basketball. Wheelchair basketball is the biggest adaptive sport that's competitive in the U.S. that we're aware of. They have it at universities, major universities, and I believe the wheelchair NBA, I believe they do pay their players. I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah.
But there's leagues and teams all over the place.
going back to America, with the size of it, and obviously you targeted the military, but the size of America and all the states is the many teams in the different states that you're trying to pull into.
At the moment,
or are you limited to, say, New York?
Yeah, at the moment, because of the fact that the U.S. doesn't have any central funding for sports,
yeah,
and everything's basically reliant on donations or sponsorship, we are having our player pool come from a very small catchment, yeah, area. And it's right now in the Carolinas. So it's about a 3-hour radius,
yeah,
from that. We were having people come from Tennessee and Virginia. The guy from Virginia.
And a young lady flying from Texas.
Yes. One of our players, Gabby, she flies in every time we train from Houston, Texas. You know, to be a part of the, yeah, to be a part of it. We had another gentleman who came up from Idaho, which is like a 6-hour flight internally, or a 4 or 4.5-hour flight internally in the U.S. But as an organization, we're trying to reimburse players for flights and travel and stuff, yeah, and it gets ridiculously expensive. So we worked out that our operating budget is going to be a lot bigger than most countries because of the sheer size of travel and things, yeah, like that. But we are going to try and expand our player pool by having regional locations similar to the NFL, where you have a division that's located in the Northeast, division in the Southeast, mm-hmm, and they play each other, you know, in a division, and then from there they play in a conference, you know, those winners and so on and so forth. That's the overall plan, so that we can still look at players without having to travel all over the U.S. and it costing an absolute fortune.
I think the important thing that we're talking about almost inadvertently is legacy from this tournament.
Oh.
And I'm interested, obviously the European Rugby League is a bit of a misnomer because it covers the Americas and Africa as well, which will be part of 2025. So I just want to go back to the men's tournament and Greece and Jamaica, which both fall under your jurisdiction. There are some people focusing, as we do in rugby league, because it's in our DNA to find the negative before the positive, that the margins of scores were important. But you were close to two nations who debuted in this World Cup, who got a huge amount out of it. Again, I had the absolute pleasure of interviewing a guy called Siobhan Bailey, who played for Jamaica from Kingston. Got that lovely drawl accent that you think, I understand every word he's saying, but I'm going to have to speed up my tape recorder when I listen back to it. He was a teacher. It was his first time over here. He played 80 minutes in the first game, which he wasn't expecting to. But he was talking about life experience and what he was going to take back, and the plan for Jamaica might be, if they can pull it off, 4 semi-professional teams in the not-too-distant future. Spent a fair bit of time with Greece, who, again, I think won everybody's hearts with the way that they played. Not necessarily the results. But you were close to both of them, and we put out a statement earlier today saying that the domestic league is kicking off in Greece this weekend, and there are 9 male teams, there are 4 female teams there. They've had issues themselves about recognition, and that now looks like it's sorted out. What sort of impact do you think nations like that have got from this World Cup, bearing in mind that performance-wise, that wasn't the criteria?
Not at all. So I think Greece is one of the best examples. So in their squad, they had 8 players that came from the domestic league. So out of a squad of 24, 8 of them were playing in the Greek comp. I think that a match day squad is 17, so 24 minus 8 is 16. So you're always guaranteed one of those players is going to play in that game. And in actual fact, they all played against Bradford, and they certainly were well rotated against France and Samoa and England when they played that. And I think the experience of being in a full-time environment with better players around them, you know, obviously they've drawn on heritage players as well that are playing in higher quality competitions. But then the exposure to the opposition as well, and the chance to sort of run out against some of the world's best, you just can't get that anywhere else. So those 8 players will take that back to Greece, they'll take that back to their clubs, they'll take the learnings that they've had from training, from video review, from S&C, from lying in a pool, whatever else it is that they've been up to while they're in Sheffield, obviously, when they've been at Lido. But they'll take that back, and they'll raise the standards within those clubs, and the players are quite well distributed as well. And I know that the plan for 2025, if Greece qualify, is that number 8 goes goes that way as well, and more people come from the domestic comp. So it's ginormous, and that, you know, that experience will be exactly the same for Jamaica. And you know, arguably the profile of the World Cup in those countries, you know, we don't know what impact that has had, but it's just that core learning and the exposure to basically doing what everybody wants to do: play for your country, be a full-time athlete, get loads of kit, and swan around signing autographs. I mean, you can't do that anywhere else, can you?
So, I think apart from the fact that Greece were clearly engaged with the Sheffield community while they were here, which is why they got beaten by 90 odd points at Bramall Lane. But the team that people wanted autographs from and selfies with when they came out of the dressing room was the Greek team.
Yeah.
Because they'd got to know some of the kids, and I think everybody appreciated the style with which they played. It wasn't what we were used to seeing. They were prepared to try things. And it's also interesting as well that talk of the domestic competition kicking off this weekend, some of those players who played in the World Cup are not now just players, they're player coaches. So they've taken on this added responsibility of saying, I've got some knowledge that I can now impart. So I think, again, relating that to you know, the squad that you brought over from America, we were talking about it in the car on the way down. It's important that we recognise that some of the people that are playing this sport don't have traditional rugby backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
We've always tried to sell in on the back of the running game. And I'm not sure that's going to ever be possible because, as you say, of all the competing sports that have. But your captain, who interviewed brilliantly, spoke very passionately and eloquently about the experience he'd had. He is a senior lecturer at a major university that prides itself on its sport.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of contact that rugby league can't get. So, yeah. You know, again, have you tasked them with going back and spreading the word and forming a club? And
well, we told them first and foremost when they all came on board and were selected for the national team that they're all ambassadors for the sport. Once they return back to the U.S., and they are going to be key in helping us develop the game and moving it forward by spreading word of the game and, you know, helping us establish other clubs in the regions where they're at, and particularly when we try and take games on the road to help speak to people, you know, because people will be asking questions not only for us, but to the athletes themselves, who are the ones who are, hey, what's it like to play the game? What's it like to have to travel? What's it, you know, all that sort of stuff that we can't answer as able-bodied athletes or people, those athletes will be able to get across the message and tell people exactly what it's like. And they're the ones that are going to draw players across, not us. And so it's very key having them on board. We have only one able body in the entire team for us.
But it's a different demographic as well, isn't it? Yeah. It's not your traditional rugby playing public. And I think the point about that is, that gives you unlimited potential.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you say, you've got to find sponsorship, and we appreciate that. You know, this is rugby league, everything is short of money.
Yeah.
But do you genuinely think that this is going to open the door to a continent where sport is king?
If certain things align right, yes. One of the things that a lot of our athletes have said is that if we get this right, wheelchair rugby league could be the biggest adaptive sports in the U.S., which is a huge statement to make. Our end goal is to have a fully professional wheelchair rugby league set up, domestic competition in the U.S., where we have athletes from England, Spain, France, and Australia wanting to play in our competition because we can draw the crowds, we can draw the money, we can draw that pool. I think it's especially in the U.S., that is 100% possible. But obviously, that's going to take time.
Yeah, it's kind of like a hidden gem, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like with the wheelchair rugby. I saw, and you've probably seen it, the advert for when USA played in Canada in America, in New York. They advertised it of all the biff without padding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when people at work have been asking me about the wind, we talked about the wheelchair. I've described it as robot walls for people.
Yeah, that's it.
They have no respect for
the copyright.
And there's little things like that that could be a good way of promoting it to show that it's action packed as well as skill.
Yeah.
Are the pitches the same size as a basketball pitch?
No.
Our pitch fit onto a basketball.
court?
No, we have to play across three basketball courts to get that dimension that we need. We could play across two, but it's a little bit compact. But ideally, we would like three courts.
So where are the stadiums or the places that can hold these games?
So in the UK, we play on smaller pitches where required. So the full-size pitch is 40 metres try line, 20 metres touchline to touchline. And as Juan says, that is, you need two and a bit basketball courts. So think about locally, there's the Institute of Sport in Sheffield, and that's it in, there's the whole university, and that's it in Yorkshire. So we don't have many three-court hall facilities. There are two in Manchester that you could put a postage stamp over. So generally in the domestic competition here, you get a lot more two-court hall basketball halls. So you can shorten the pitch or narrow it slightly, but some teams just play on a basketball court or slightly bigger as well. So it's not optimal because you've not got the same width, and obviously your defensive patterns look a little bit different.
So for the Leeds one with it, because they play the Becky.
This is one of the smallest. And it doesn't actually suit Leeds. They do enjoy playing away because they tend to play on slightly bigger pitches, which suits their style. But Leeds is an interesting one because it's got a 10,000 capacity arena, which is the perfect size, but probably too big at the moment. And it's got Leeds Beckett, which is ideal for the amount of supporters that they draw, but not really big enough. So, but that's a growing pain. It doesn't apply as much in America because obviously the college system means that there are greater facilities that you would have access to.
There is a lot of facilities around there. It's just convincing and showing the maintenance ground guys, whatever you want to call them, that manage those facilities to say, this sport will not damage the floor. That's their biggest concern. So the venue that we train at, we had to show them, hey, just let us practice there. We'll show you it's not going to tear up your floor. It just scuffs it like basketball does. And, those scuffs come up, like anything else. So we've had some interest from different organizations who one of them actually came to us and said, we'd like to see if you guys would be available to play this at a NBA halftime. And I was like, yeah, that'd be huge. That hasn't materialized yet, but there are opportunities for us there, and there's plenty of venues. The problem that we might have with some of the venues is they're huge. It's not like here where you can get a smaller venue. We're talking minimum 25,000, and the cost associated with that, would be huge. Unless we're bringing across England for a three-test series, Australia for a three-test series, which we want to do, we might be able to fill that if we can find, those teams that come across and find everything that we need to make that happen. But just for us as domestic leagues, we're probably going to be small, playing in somewhere smaller, just to keep the cost down at the moment.
So there's plenty of venues.
There's plenty. There's loads of them. Yeah.
The stands are just the same as the running game, really, though, well, aren't they? In a good way, I mean.
Yeah.
So let's look at the three tournaments. We'll come back to wheelchair last because you were both involved in it, and it is actually the water cooler moment for rugby league that so many people are talking about wheelchair that wouldn't normally engage with the sport. So we'll come back to that because I think that's been the jewel in this World Cup crown. So we'll start with the men's. Obvious question is ask your highlight moments. See, I haven't done any homework. And then we could try and evaluate if that was a success or not. And was it in any way tarnished by England not getting to the final?
My highlight moment is 18,760 people at Bramall Lane watching England versus Greece. So having worked in development of rugby, of both codes in South Yorkshire for nearly 20 years, to have the national team playing in Sheffield.
At the same time as Wednesday.
At the same time as Sheffield Wednesday, and get a record crowd for a game of rugby league in Sheffield, it was fantastic.
And you got a Wednesday fan signed up for England games.
Yeah, of course. We've got loads of it as well. I think that's the whole reason why England wore blue and white, to be honest, in this tournament as well, to appeal to the Sheffield Wednesday crowd. But no, that was mine for me, Phil. And people will look at that crowd and say, well, it's not 25,000 that we got it. At Bolton the week before. No, it wasn't. It was fantastic there.
Mm. Any highlights from the men's tournament?
For me, all I got to watch was the final, which I know most people would be like, oh, but it was obviously
for me, that was great seeing Samoa play in the final, because usually it's always Australia, New Zealand, Australia, England, you know. So seeing a different team there was fantastic. And there's a lot of supporters there for Samoa, but obviously afterwards as well, it was fantastic because you met so many supporters from Samoa and they saw the same colors and they were like, oh, you support Samoa. And then they saw the wheelchair for the U.S. and they were like, hey, we watched you guys on TV. You guys did fantastic. So not only did they watch the men's game and they're support the men's game of Samoa, but a lot of people did watch the wheelchair games as well, which for us, especially for myself, having grown up for the most, I don't say grown up, but having lived here for so long, to have somebody come up and say, oh yeah, I support, you know, Samoa, but I actually watch wheelchair rugby league and I watch the U.S. is huge.
I think two of the highlights that we shouldn't forget in a hurry, because I think they sum up what's best about rugby league. First one was the quarterfinal between Tonga and Samoa, the simultaneous Civitau and Civitau, that went you know, ridiculously global and was a wash on social media. Not many sports could do that. I just felt extremely proud that that was rugby league, that those two nations showed so much of their heritage, but respect for each other. They then went on and knocked 10 bells out of each other as well, which was even better. I think the other thing, you talking about Samoa, The Rock, again, I have to confess, yes, at my age, not somebody I've ever come across, but apparently he's quite famous. Obviously, of Samoan heritage, I'm pretty sure in those few days before the actual final, he didn't really know what rugby league was. But he put out a message that hit 350 million Instagram followers.
Yeah.
And the passion that he spoke of what you've got to do to represent Samoa and what it would mean to the nation. And I think, again, that's something that rugby league can't normally do. And it would be criminal, actually, to not capitalise on that. But it just showed you, again, what we are capable of when we get it right.
I will some of that speech.
Well, see, just him putting that out, there's a lot of Pacific Islanders on the west coast of the United States. One of the guys over on the west coast who is, you know, running a lot of the games out there basically called us and said, just from The Rock putting out that on social media, we've been inundated with calls and emails of people wanting to play the game, and because they found out, hey, there's local rugby league in the U.S. can we get involved? So it has helped, you know, an impact immediately. You know, somebody who's got 385 million, you know, social media followers on one platform. So that was fantastic.
I think he knows more about rugby league than you think. His cousin is Junior Bye Bye.
Well, yes, but whether he has ever been approached by Hulk KR, that we don't know.
Man can dream, a man can dream.
We can pick out performances. I thought the Australia-New Zealand semi-final at Ellen Road was the closest we'll get over here to seeing Origin in our back garden.
That had O'Connor tries.
Yeah, I think Kevin Sinfield. Yeah, Kevin Sinfield entering the stadium at Old Trafford at halftime wasn't a dry eye in the house, which again reflects so well on not just him as a human being and what he's doing and why he's doing it, but that was a rugby league audience that took him to their heart.
And I've seen that picture of Mel Meninga shaking his hand.
Yeah, and they were
the love between them.
Well, it's interesting. We got the chance to have a Skype call with Kevin today to just talk about what he'd done, which you'll be able to read about in the next 40 minutes. But again, he said it wasn't that they said anything to each other, it was the fact that they knew. But there aren't many coaches whose team were playing in a World Cup final at half time that would make their way out to shake their hands with somebody.
Yeah,
which again tells you again all about the values of the sport, which I think we forget when we say, oh, a stadium was empty. I think Middlesbrough was a great experience. It was a game that was probably the least enjoyable of all the matches that we saw in the group stage because it wasn't competitive. But so many of the fans that were there were talking about, I've never been exposed to rugby league before. What a great game. What fantastic skills. When we left the ground at Newcastle on the opening day, 50% of the people there were from the northeast. You didn't hear people as you were leaving saying, oh, I thought the ticket prices were high, or I didn't get the seat that I wanted, or the PA system failed for 10 minutes. What went on there? They were just, they'd had a great experience. They'd seen their national team play on their pitch and enjoyed it. So I think we lose track of those. Ben Jones-Bishop scoring Jamaica's first try in his 300th appearance.
And guard of honour for him to leave.
All of that. So they're the good things. We have to talk about England.
Do we have to?
should the minimum requirement of England, bearing in mind that, you know, part of your role as ERL encompasses England being the leading nation in the Northern Hemisphere, should the minimum requirement have been to get to the final, can they therefore be classed as having failed in this tournament?
I'll be careful answering that.
Now, Sean's not watching. You
don't. I don't think you can put a requirement on a team to do something for that. I think you have to. The team has to perform and meet its own objectives. So, you know, I'm sure that John Dutton and Chris Brindley and Dean Harmon didn't sit down with a plan and say England have to do this. You know, would the talk, the final have been even fuller than it was, and even more of a spectacle if England were there? I'm sure it would have been. I'm fortunate to have been to a World Cup final that featured England, but not in this country. And it wasn't that full there. So, you know, I remember 2013, Australia versus New Zealand at Old Trafford, fantastic crowd and day out. So, you know, I'm sure they're disappointed, and I'm sure that every team coming into that World Cup dreamt of winning it, some planned to win it, and some were disappointed that they weren't in the opportunity, you know, didn't have the opportunity to win it. But as for whether they failed or not, I don't know. I'd want to see what their objectives were.
All right, then let me put it another way. The worst performance ever in Golden Point extra time.
Was it?
Yes, they were a trap. They never got out of their own hands.
I've seen a few.
they had three possessions and managed to mess up all three of them.
Yeah. Personal opinion of that, well, they tried to play out as if they had 80 minutes. They panicked and tried stuff that you wouldn't do.
No, I think the interesting thing about the men's and women's England teams is they seem to want to play in a very structured way, which is in the image of their coach. And that's fine when you're winning. And there was nobody criticising any team selections when the team was winning. The perceived weaknesses with the selections came when they lose, and you can't change the way that you play. So it's great bringing Chris Hill off the bench, but when you're 20 points to 12 down, Chris Hill is not going to win you that game. He's going to help you not lose it, but who's the player that's going to add the spark that you need when you're behind? And I think both the men and the women probably suffered a little bit from that, if we're talking solely England.
I'm just thinking back to the start of the tournament, well, before the start of the tournament, we all say it's a failure now, but looking back to when the teams were selected, a lot of people wrote it off before the tournament even started, when you look back.
I think we assumed, looking at the draw and being realistic about the respective competitions in the Northern and Southern Hemisphere, that we would probably get beaten in the semi-final by Tonga, which would have been a repeat of the 2017 semi-final, where Tonga went within seconds of winning that game. And I think that would have been, you could have almost justified that, because Tonga were on an upward curve and they'd started this tier two nation that is attracting heritage-based players. I think when we saw it was Samoa, and we'd beaten them so well in the first game, and that we'd done psychologically so well to get it back to 26-all when we hadn't played particularly well, that we thought the team would go on then and probably do the job. And I think that was a disappointment coming out of Arsenal, where again, there was a great crowd of just over 40,000.
I don't think it was a golden point, for some reason, just seeing panic.
And again, having said that, when you get over your disappointment, that I'll probably never live long enough to see a running team win the World Cup.
In any sport.
That, the viewing figures were, you know, 2 million, which was astonishing. And the game itself was
highest,
magnificent.
Viewing figure.
See, my perspective of it, when you're on about that question about failure, is when his squad came out, it did surprise me, but I didn't think he had a, maybe a plan B, C, like you say. It was like an old made of players that would qualify for playing for Wigan with this style of play.
And I get that every coach...
And I couldn't see any attacking fire.
Well, and again... If we assume that maybe Sam Tompkins wasn't fit and Jack Welsby looked a bit out of place at standoff, at some point in a game that you're losing, why not try switching Jack Welsby to fullback? Or,
yeah.
Try something different. See, and I think both the men and the women.
Letzky were injured.
He could have played.
Yeah, but then you got the surprise. Callum Watkins seemed to roll the years back. So did Ryan Hall when he played.
But as a legacy thing.
Yes.
We're quite good, especially the English, glorifying our defeats. So, you know, Maradona hadn't got it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's probably the only game from Mexico that anybody remembers. Right? Was it 2013? You know, when we lost to New Zealand in the last minute?
Yeah.
That's been shown loads of times.
Yeah.
We don't remember any other game in that tournament. We remember that.
So the Crichton's drop goal.
And so probably this drop goal thing, it'll become one of those things.
I think you're right.
And again, like when we lost to Australia, the only thing we show is that.
Yeah, the ankle tap.
The ankle tap.
I remember that.
Even that. So we build this sort of mythology up around, you know, we're only just beaten by this and that and the other. Okay, if England had got through, Old Trafford would have been full. Those other 15,000 tickets would have sold for me. You know, I know people who were sat on their phones ready to press buy. Do you know what I mean?
I think you're right. And the only reason I posed that question was clearly to provoke a debate, and it's really interesting. But I also think that from a media point of view, there were a lot of features planned in that last week leading up to Old Trafford that were dropped by some national newspapers because England weren't in it, and they switched their focus to the Football World Cup.
Yeah.
We did get some fantastic coverage in the papers. Newspapers were ringing up wanting the story of Greece. They don't do that normally. But I think having England in the final would have given us a huge boost in terms of profile.
What was the TV coverage?
It was brilliant. I mean, I think... I don't know if they released the individual figures for the final, but I think over 30 million people have watched the BBC during the course.
I saw that, and they go, this is really good. And I saw one of the persons go, we're amazing.
I think...
Is that 30 million people? Or is that 1 million? Is that the, you know, 500,000 rugby league supporters watching 60 games?
I think we can come back to that when we talk about wheelchair, because clearly that generated an audience that had nothing to do with traditional rugby league.
Yeah.
So we've dissected, if you like, the men's tournament. I tried to get you to blame Sean Wayne, but you wouldn't. I don't blame him, by the way. I think he went with what he felt would be his strongest squad, and what happened in Newcastle opened everybody's eyes, and all the criticism fell away, and we just couldn't. Again, there's a debate to be had about our domestic competition. Do we prepare our players enough for playing four, possibly five, highly intense games week after week when our domestic competition doesn't give us that? So back to you, administrators and IMG, to sort that out. But no, I thought it would have been great to have England in the final. And the fact that we've got a game that we'll talk about forever, which was won by a golden point extra time, probably about as good as we could have expected. So go to the women. And I think before the competition started, we all expected that the teams from particularly Australia and New Zealand would be physically more developed, faster, more technical, more skillful than anything we could put up with because of the strength of the NRLW, which we all had the privilege of watching. So England getting to a semi-final and taking New Zealand close, certainly a lot closer than when they played New Zealand in the semi-final 5 years before. Women's tournament go down as a success?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I think when you talk about the tournament, we're not talking about the home team. So the opening day in front of 10,000 people at Headingley, a record crowd for women's internationals, standalone fixtures as well. I don't think anybody can complain about that. You know, all of the games were broadcast on the BBC. There were some great crowds. There were some great stories around it. So one of the games, you know, we saw all of the GB Lionesses go and receive their long overdue and hard-earned caps that quite frankly should have been awarded in the 80s and 90s when they were earned and shouldn't have had to have waited 30 years to get that recognition. And that, you know, was born out of, well, one woman's belligerence, Julia, you know who you are, but also the fact that we had a platform to do it. At the same time, we've seen three women enrolled into the Hall of Fame, And I can tell you, it's not that long ago that I wrote a nomination for a player and was told it won't be the Hall of Fame, but it will be the Roll of Honour. So attitudes have changed as a result. So, you know, did England, I don't care whether England performed or not, quite frankly, was the women's, you know, the tournament a roaring success? Yes, it was. And the fact that my rough calculations of counting people at Old Trafford suggested that I think there were about 20,000-35,000 people in the ground at the point when the game kicked off. We wouldn't have had that 7 or 8 years ago now. So absolutely success. You didn't ask me what my highlight was though.
Well, if you don't say Edna Santini, I'm not speaking to you.
Well, I'm going to cheat, right? My highlight isn't from the tournament because I didn't really get to engage much with the women's tournament because of the wheelchair running concurrently, although I did go to the final things. But I went to the France v Brazil game, which was a friendly at Featherstone, home of rugby, International Rugby League in Featherstone before the game kicked off. And the highlight for me was at the end of the game, the two games came together and they shook hands. And then it was almost like somebody had realised foot presence. And then Brazil ran off into the changing room and came back with literally wrapped presents and bags and gifts. And the French women all sort of went, oh yeah, we've got presents too. They ran off. So the Brazilians were all stood there going, where are they gone? And they came out and, you know, crossed the language barrier, they exchanged gifts and things. And then they all lined up along the 20-metre line and were led in a rendition of the Macarena. And I thought to myself, this has got, I was definitely involved. This is not rugby league as we know it, but this is what
we're just having a good time.
But this is what I like rugby league.
That's
you go on tour, you meet friends, you exchange gifts, you do things that are a little bit wacky that you wouldn't normally do, but you're quite happy to talk about them when you get home. And
you're trying to smash the living.
Yeah, you've just gone 7 miles out for 80 minutes, and now you're swapping Instagram and all of that sort of thing. And I thought, for the two teams who ended up finishing bottom of their respective pools, I only wish that was their experience at the end of the tournament, that they'd had that opportunity to go home. They probably had their peak enjoyment before the tournament kicked off.
So you presumably saw the women's final.
Yeah.
So as a coach, or with your coaching hat on, do you sit there and admire how skillful the Australians were and the fact that they could do that relentlessly for 80 minutes? And do we get too wound up with the margin of the score and we don't focus enough on the brilliance that got us to that score?
Yeah, I do think there is a point where, especially for a lot of people who are involved with the game, you have to switch off your brain to enjoy the game. But when you're looking at it from a coaching standpoint, and you're looking at how good they are and some of the things that are, you know, some of the moves that they're able to put on and set them up, you know. And sometimes, even in the wheelchair game, I notice this, they're setting up for two plays. You can see, at least I can, they're setting up, hey, they're not setting up for this play. They're setting up for two or three plays down the line to get something off. And for them to be able to do that and how skillful they are doing that just shows the amount of time they've had at high-level training, high-level, you know, competitions, and also how well they gel as a squad to come together. So I really enjoyed it in all aspects of it, seeing these finals.
I think there's been a number of highlight games, but certainly in the women's, the highlight game for me was Brazil and Canada, which the final group game, nothing riding on it. 10-10 going into the very last play of the game. The try that Brazil have scored is a 100-metre interception. We need more Edna's in the game. I want an Edna Santini shirt. And Canada come up with the most ridiculous play involving two kicks and a ball that spins back over the dead ball line to win it in the final second. And both nations embrace each other. But these are nations that represent a continent each, Canada and Brazil, at Headingley. And the joy, the unbridled joy of those two nations, because Canada had got their win and Jamaica had come so close and Brazil had come so close, and they weren't desperately upset that they lost in the last minute. They felt that they had something they could build on to go back home with, and they were all singing and dancing and doing a worm in front of the south stand. It's like that. Those are the highlight moments, I think, and we shouldn't forget those or undervalue those. So that's the men's and the women's. The highlight of the tournament has clearly been wheelchair. It's the perfect televisual sport. Everything. It's a bit like snooker. When we first got snooker on the television, the size of your screen is the size of the table. Nothing happens that you can't see or be involved with. It's exactly the same in the wheelchair. There's nothing extraneous.
It's funny you say that, because that's what I thought it was like watching the finals. It's like all the lights were dark. All you could see was the pitch. I was like, this is like a snooker match.
Huge trip hazard. Yeah. 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 On the edge. Yeah. I'm in the dark.
We got huge television audiences. We got games upgraded from the red button to BBC Two. We got people in other sports talking about what they'd watched the night before. We got a congratulatory tweet from Ipswich Town Football Club to England when they won the title. No, Ipswich Town. So first of all, was that the jewel in the crown? And then we'll talk about how we can best capitalise on that. You were involved, so clearly your perspective will be different to mine. But
obviously, it was the jewel in the crown, not least because of our involvement. I think the wheelchair tournament did a lot of great things. One, it reached new audiences. The times that the games were on for TV definitely captured a daytime market, and I understand there are a few tweets about Gardener's World having to move, and most of the gardeners seem to fall in love with it as well. But I think it raised the bar in terms of production. So obviously they've still not taken the floor up in Sheffield, where Richard is now there, but the fact that we moved out of the sports hall floor, everybody made a lot about the floor, by the way, just a wooden sprung floor that it goes in most sports halls. But the vinyl, the clear pitch with no other line markings on, the fact that we could get lights on it, an indoor arena, you can change your production around, raise the bar. That's tough for people like me who's got to run the next Continental Championships following. We haven't got the same budget, but it showed what can be done. And I think there's a number of things. We reminded people that wheelchair rugby league is an inclusive sport. It's not a disability sport. So there is no other sport I can think of in this world, or team sport anyway, where disabled people can play with non-disabled people. At domestic level, we've got families that never thought they could play sport together. Who can do that, and in the past, obviously Jack and Harry Brown, both playing with each other as well, is unthinkable in many sports. So we reminded people of that, but I think we also reminded people that disabled athletes don't need wrapping up in cotton wool. We saw some of the big hits, we saw some of the the anger and the frustration and the aggression coming out there, and I think we reminded the nation that just because you're sat in a wheelchair doesn't mean that you need to be wrapped in cotton wool or treated any differently. So, I think that was probably some of the highlights that have come out of it. But to go to Manchester, 4,500 people, the production in the I wanted to call it the GMX in Manchester Central. The lights were literally the lights were the border of the pitch, and I was in goal. I know if I stood back 2 centimetres from the edge of the pitch, I fell off this premises and couldn't find a water bottle and things like that. But it was absolutely superb. And people who went to that final, who may not have been a rugby league fan or maybe were a rugby league fan, will have seen the game literally in an entirely different light. We put on a show that night. We didn't put on a game, and the game was part of the overall show. And it's the razzmatazz that sells. People. My daughter came to watch one of the games, and she doesn't care what happens on the field. She was telling me about the autographs she'd collected. She got a pin badge. John Dutton had given her a notebook. She'd seen Claire Balding and had a photo with her. And apparently there's some rugby broke out at some point, and Dad was involved. But that's what it brought to me. It just took everything to a new level. I'm so excited about it. I'm sure we are.
talking perhaps with the perspective of those who are working inside the game rather than the rest of us who just loved everything we saw. The interesting contradiction throughout all of the tournaments was that some people were complaining about margins. The biggest margins up until the final were in the wheelchair, but those same people were saying, I love the wheelchair, I can't get enough of it. That final was something else. Tom Coyd said in the lead up to it, he thought it would be low scoring because you had two nations who prided themselves on their defence and who going through the tournament had shown how good they were defensively. Can you put into context for us, quality wise, how good that final was?
I think it's really difficult to put into context that because unless you're involved with it and see, you know, how physical it is to be able to position yourself the way they did, the way England has a set structure for their defensive line, and they use that very well against France. And France, to, you know, their credit, a lot of people think, oh, they're just always attacking, but their defense is also very good. They get back extremely quickly and they swarm. You know, so defensively, it was a very, very good game. It's just two completely different styles of defending, which obviously both work. But when you're playing the two best nations each other, I mean, obviously they're gonna find some holes, and they did. But you know, for us, we picked up a lot from that, from the skills that we saw as a team from every game, not just the you know France game or the England games we watched. So there was a lot of positives for us to take away from that. But you could see that they were, you know, a caliber above. And even with the score lines, what they were, we felt we did really well considering that we were first, you know, debutant nation, and it's first time we've ever played France, and they always put 100 on us. Okay. Yeah, it's a big score line. But they put 156 on Wales. And Wales are number three in the world, first time we've ever played. And for a period there in the first half, they didn't score on us for 20 minutes. And physically, we were able to keep up with them from, you know, being able to go up and down the pitch with them. Skill-wise, different story, but that's why they're number one team in the world, and they have an impressive domestic competition that they are, you know, playing in week in, week out. So, you know.
I think as well, we talk often about wheelchair ability does yield higher scores. You know, 50 points to 20 game in wheelchair would be equivalent to a sort of 24-6, 24-8 game in the running game. So I don't think we need to read too much into that. What that does tell us, though, is I couldn't tell you what the score from the final was. to be honest,
you were working.
I wasn't writing the scores down. All I'm dealing with everything else. But you know, it was low scoring, and that, you know, you're very much in the 6-8, you know, 8-10 sort of category there, which tells you that it's either a game for the purists or very good defence.
I think again, we've all fallen in love more with rugby league, with wheelchair rugby league. I think, as a magazine, Richard will confirm, we saw the potential of it quite early on, and we've been champions of that and the women's game because it is rugby league. And I think the legacy of this World Cup is, do we now have another product? Can we now sell this aside from the running game? We talked about potentially opening doors in a nation like America, but when we have our next television deal, which will only be at the end of next year, do we now not say, oh, we'll throw you in a couple of wheelchair games, but actually you need to now bid for this. This is a product that you can stand alongside any other sporting rights that you may go out and buy. And how do we achieve that?
Yeah, I mean, domestically here, definitely that is an opportunity. And you look at you know, the Super League final, the Challenge Cup final, the recent tests, you know, I mentioned England v Wales, where being in France test earlier this year, the November series last year, all being broadcast on either Sky or the BBC. And, you know, production is fairly easy, dealing with a much smaller facility, so, you know, we don't need the helicopter up there or anything like that, and you can get away with less cameras. So it's a lot easier to do the production for, and I think it is genuinely exciting. So I think people have seen that. Obviously, from a commercial broadcaster's point of view, there's potential for different marketing, different advertisers to come in involved in that. So, you know, I'm sure that's something that, you know, the guys selling the TV deal locally will be considering. And certainly from a, you know, from an international perspective, yeah, absolutely, it's a separate event. You know, we'll have the running game European Championships in October next year. There is plans for a wheelchair tournament as well, which we're just working through some fine detail on, but they won't be plugged in together. One, we haven't got the resource to deliver it all in one go, but actually, you know, it deserves to stand alone and have its own place. So, you know, I'm sure it'll come forward. And if you think about Channel 4 as a broadcaster, the home of the Paralympic Games, it feels like a great fit.
I think domestically we are seeing...
I think we're being politely wound up.
Yeah.
I've got one more question, if that's all.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm just giving a little one.
We're going to be locked in.
I do think domestically we are seeing the benefits. I mean, I'll be honest, before the World Cup, I never ever watched a game of wheelchair rugby league. And as soon as I saw it, I fell in love with it straight away. And I work in Sheffield, live in Doncaster. Most people don't really care about any form of rugby league. But I had people coming up to me saying, have you been watching the wheelchair as well?
It's the fastest 80 minutes of rugby league you'll ever see in your life. It's non-stop. I mean, with the action. And I mean, like with our match against even Wales, obviously we're, you know, it was our decider, 50-38. That's a very close score line in wheelchair rugby league, because that's only three tries and that can be scored like that. Exactly. So, you know, it was a close game for us.
I strongly believe as well that, you know, people are starting to see the benefit. I prefer to play the running game than wheelchair because some of the collisions are just frightening.
Yeah.
But you can see that clubs are starting to take note as well. I mean, Michael Hawke out today, they mentioned that they're looking at the possibility of opening
Salford a wheelchair team.
Well, Lee Leopards now are interested in, you know, they were there at the finals and the semifinals and were like, hey, what, you know, we think we should get a wheelchair game going, you know, wheelchair team. So
clearly a market there that's wanting to be tapped into.
So we'll end.
23 participants on Monday night in Sheffield.
We'll end with one question, which everybody can answer, not just the panel. The World Cup promised us the biggest, the best, and the most inclusive.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
There you are. I think
criticism.
Of course, this is.
You're going to have to ask her a question. Never end on a negative. Never end on a negative.
Yeah, nothing to do with that.
FIDEIL.
Yeah.
They played one World Cup, one part of it.
I think, again, it wasn't part of the official World Cup. Yeah. It was a showcase. And I think this is going to roll out to much bigger and better things.
Yeah,
but you have to start somewhere.
There will be.
No, that's why I've just.
Yeah. And of course, the greatest thing is that Leeds had never had a captain who had lifted a World Cup in their history. And then they got two in a week.
Okay. Yeah, I think with the PDRL, one, you have to remember that PDRL was nowhere near as advanced as it is now. And these World Cups were awarded six, 7 years ago.
Yeah. You know, so it's
again, it's in and it's great that it was part of it.
It wasn't part of the, they're starting to take the floor up actually behind Richard now.
I think,
but it's not part of the.
I just mean that.
So I think you were talking about people flying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I was reading somewhere or the Australian guy who was always on the telly. He was talking about there's some person who drives from Cornwall up to Warrington, to play PDRL and then drives back again.
So
they're training on a Wednesday and back again.
That's not
flying. It's like from an airline. You know what I mean?
Passion.
Probably can't get live from Cornwall to Manchester.
Thank you all for coming. I think we'll leave with the enduring image of the World Cup, which we probably haven't got time to go and get everybody's. I think it was seeing those three teams simultaneously lift their trophies at Old Trafford and the bulk of the crowd stay there and applaud them. Most inclusive World Cup ever? Absolutely. That one picture summed it up.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Just asking a light.
No.
Did
the Welsh player pay for that damaged door at Sheffield?
A lot is made about things on the TV that perhaps aren't reality.
You just showed passion from them. That's what I thought.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.